Okay, so because I'm wearing two hats and I'm actually moderating as well as presenting, I have the really awkward task of reading my own bio. So I'm just going to read it because it's a lot easier than trying to remember what I've done. So currently I work for the Monterey County Health Department in the Planning, Evaluation, and Policy Unit. I hold a master's degree in urban public health from Charles R. Drew University of Medicine and Science in Los Angeles, California. And I currently serve as the Health Equity and Cultural Competency Coordinator for the Monterey County Health Department, where I lead staff in the development of our department's health equity programs and partnerships through a health and all policies framework. Okay. So Monterey County is a little over 3,000 square miles and it's located on California's central coast. As you can see here on the picture, it's about a 5 hours drive north of Los Angeles County and then a 2 hour drive south of San Francisco County. Monterey County's 12 incorporated cities comprise approximately 75% of the population and 15% of the total land area. We have a little over 426,000 residents, and that was according to our census in 2014. We have a really large Hispanic and Latino population. The percentage is about 57% in our entire county, and our median income is a little over $59,000 a year. And I put these two numbers here because I think they really speak to sort of the disparities that exist in our county. You can see that the median home price in our county is $455,000 a year. Majority of our county is agricultural based, so it's a large ag community where, I mean, this $59,000 median income is huge compared to what our ag workers actually make. So in 2011, we began the update of our strategic plan. And one of the things that came out, I'll read the exact quote from our strat plan that says, this is from a community member. She said, people don't feel safe. There's no lighting. There's poor or no sidewalks. Bushes are overgrown and they're causing fire hazards. There's gangs. It's dangerous. We really don't feel safe for our kids to walk to school. There's no crossing guards. Parents are working hard. So they have a difficult time actually, you know, facilitating the movement of their children. And so we brought this back to the health department and we, you know, really looked at, well, what can we actually do to improve this, right? This is public health, or this is, you know, economic development issues, or these are you know, issues outside of our control. So we really looked at incorporating a health and all policies framework to address some of these issues, realizing that policy change actually comes from a number of different sectors. So we were trying to figure out how we could actually work with all of these different sectors. So because we are public health experts, we did some research and we really wanted to move away from the traditional medical model of how health departments have functioned for a number of years. We started looking at the downstream efforts, so addressing outcomes, right? We have a number of different programs around smoking cessation, obesity. We make our money actually in addressing the outcomes of social determinant issues. And moving upstream, like Aaron talked about, we wanted to look at the socio-ecological model of public health and how we could actually move upstream. And those areas of work actually are comprised of some really difficult topic areas. So we actually look at race and class and gender, immigration status, who holds the power. So looking at institutional power and social inequities. This framework really allows us to actually get at the root cause issues of what are causing the health outcomes we're working on in the first place. So one of the first things that I did when I came on board in 2013, I knew that I wanted to implement a training program for our department staff to go through so they could learn more about health inequities and disparities because they are so persistent in our communities. And so I called up Alameda County after doing some research and called up Riverside County. And I sort of, these are literally my notes that I took during that time. And I devised, you know, these columns which have Alameda County's information, Riverside County's, and I looked at these areas. I looked at curriculum development. So in Monterey County, I knew that we wanted to apply an internal and external approach to developing the curriculum. So this curriculum we actually vetted with community members as well as bureau chiefs internally. We also consulted with experts, and that is comprised of the research efforts done here. You see that I noted here that Monterey County actually has no workforce development team. So it is a very difficult process for one person to actually pull together a training such as this one. We also don't have ESS services that are readily available for our staff. Of course, we have those benefits and people can sort of do it on their time off, but there was no way we could coordinate with ESS to actually have people come in during some of our more difficult sessions. So we figured that we'd try to coordinate with behavioral health to actually have maybe a therapist sit in or whatever the case may be, just because we were a little bit concerned about the the feelings that this material actually brings up. So as far as staff assessment goes, we based our presentation off of our all staff results. So we have an annual all staff meeting where all of our health department employees, and I should mention we have a little over 900 full-time health department staff, which is really large. Hearing Aaron's numbers, that's pretty big compared to the size of the population that we actually serve. We utilize pre and post tests for each evaluation, or we utilize module evaluations for each module, and then we have a pre-test and a post-test. Our curriculum rollout was developed using a cohort style method. So we also do the 25 people in each cohort, and they do take it in successive order. When we first started out, I was actually developing the material as we were going through the trainings. And so we were holding the sessions bi-monthly, but after I had the material down, I switched it to monthly because I didn't want so much time in between each of the modules. We wanted people to really get a good grasp of everything that we were discussing. And then facilitators, training, coordinators, all of that good stuff, that is me, one person. So what I utilized is actually a multitude of different materials to actually convey the message. So we use TED Talks, we use YouTube, whatever we can use, outside presenters to actually come if they have certain areas of expertise. But the implementation, the design, the evaluation component, that was on myself. And we did community trial runs, so we actually had these discussions with community members as well, and those conversations are ongoing. As far as participant selection, the selection is self-selection. So we developed an application process where our employees have the opportunity to apply themselves, of course, with sign-off from their managers. And that's both a good and bad thing, and we'll talk a little bit about why that's the case a little bit later. And then it's a 4-hour module, and then there's a commitment to 20 hours for the duration of the entire course. And the role of leadership is extremely important in the development of this process. My unit, the Planning, Evaluation, and Policy unit, actually sits in administration in our department. And so one of our goals is to sort of break down silos. And that's really the reason that we were able to do this, because administration really sees a need for it. So the director sends a memo in support, and then we do recognition in our employee evaluations in the graduation. So we try to make the graduations a really big deal, and we encourage our staff to actually include those, include their certificates in their annual evaluations. So the mission of our Health Equity Scholars Academy is that we want to strive to empower all Monterey County Health Department employees to affect change in our county. And the vision is the Health Equity Scholars Academy explores being active within the context of a systems-oriented approach to enhancing people's status to address health inequities and injustices in our local communities. So as far as implementation goes, we went back to the Alameda County module setup where we used the 5 module curriculum. Looking back, it's one of those things where you never know how it's going to go until you actually do it. Looking back, we probably would have done the 6 modules as well, because they do focus on those specific populations, which always feel a little bit rushed for me. And I'd love to take more time to talk about LGBTQ communities, disabled communities. So I would encourage you to consider that. You guys have heard the bulk of what we cover in this in the modules, but module one sets the foundation for those who don't have a public health background. So we cover the 10 essential services of public health, the three core functions of public health, all the good stuff we all know and love. In module two, we actually look at cultural competency and inclusion. One of the unique things that I love when I was reviewing the material from Alameda County was actually looking at the cultural competency continuum. So it starts with cultural destructiveness and goes on the middle of the continuum, actually looks at cultural blindness, which is where majority of our populations actually sit, right? They say, we don't want to see color. It's not there. We're all the same. We all have the same opportunities. And this, I think, is really that turning point for most people in the material, because they realize our opportunities are all different. And oftentimes they are based on, you know, where we come from or where we live or what family we were born into. So I like to think of this module as being the shift in perspective for most people. And then it ends with advanced competency, which does not mean that, you know, there's ever an end game to it. I think most people sort of go back and forth on that spectrum. Module three looks at an overview of race as a social construct. So Aaron talked about some of the biology of race, right? So some of the materials that we use are unnatural causes, which is an amazing resource in itself. It has a toolkit that you can utilize to help evaluate the materials. We use The Gardener's Tale by Dr. Kamara Phyllis-Jones, who I saw earlier. And it's an amazing allegory for people to understand the relationship between institutional racism and individual racism, how that impacts one's health. And we also use materials from a professor named Professor John Powell, who's up at Berkeley. And his research focuses on implicit bias and what that looks like and how, you know, our brains are sort of compartmentalized to look at things a certain way. And if we know that and if we're aware of that, how do we break down those barriers? Module four is social and health equity. It increases awareness of how historical and current policies link to social inequities, which then link to health inequities. And then module five is the big one for community capacity building. And we look at community capacity building from an asset-based approach, and we work to build a power base of residents and staff who can actually advocate for equitable distribution of resources. So these are our pretest results, and it looks at knowledge levels in certain areas. Of course, we tested a number of different areas, but I just pulled out the four that were relevant to today's talk. So you'll see the four areas that we looked at were cultural humility, racism and health, social determinants, and health inequities. And you can see that majority of people coming into the modules, they're pre-test, before they've even seen any of the materials or information, rated themselves as having relatively low levels of knowledge around these areas. And so their knowledge was very limited. In the post-test, and as a reminder, we did module evaluations as well, just to make sure that the content we were covering was appropriate. But in the post-test, you can see that there was 95% of folks said that they strongly agreed or agreed that they knew more about cultural humility, 98% across the board for racism and health, social determinants and health inequities. And the program actually has amazing evaluation results. So here's one of the quotes from one of the participants. She said that this training should be required for all health department staff and opened up to all of the county. Our community would benefit from this. Managers and staff should also be equally allowed and encouraged to access these trainings. Social justice begins at home. Our health department is our home. Empowered employees increase productivity and are part of this community we are introducing these policies to. So as you can see, based on that quote, a lot of people get a lot of really good information out of this material. So some of the successes that we've had, this is one of the only opportunities in our department for some cross-bureau learning. We have some QI programs going on as well, but there just aren't very many opportunities for environmental health folks to sit across from behavioral health folks or administration people to sit across from you know, behavioral health or public guardian. We actually have a public guardian in our department. We also have created a safe space for tough conversations. A lot of these conversations are really, really difficult to have, and because I'm the sole facilitator, I try my best to leave all of the educational material out the door. And I know that sounds kind of bad to say, right? But a lot of what I think I bring to the material is actually telling my story, right? These are things that I've experienced and that I've learned from over the course of my life history, and I've shared those experiences with people so that they don't see me as this person, you know, with a degree, which majority of our folks in this program don't have a degree. They could be anything from an office assistant to, you know, anybody within our department has the opportunity to participate. But I like to take the educational component out and talk about things that we all, you know, have experienced on a regular basis in our lives. I think it's a success that our process is a self-selection process for who gets to participate, but I also think it's a double-edged sword, so I'll talk about that on the next slide. And then Public Health Bureau has, their leadership has a really big commitment to this work. So our public health nurses are in the Public Health Bureau, and regardless of their time that they have to be out in the field, somehow, some way, their leadership has decided they will take this training. And so even though it's not mandatory, you know, their leadership specifically has said, we're going to figure out how to do it. Now, I'm working on a case study to figure out how they did that, because I don't even know. But it's amazing to have that sort of support. We've trained and we've graduated 66 staff members, so that sounds really low compared to what you guys have, Erin. But I'm working on it. The use of multimedia, which I've talked about, and then professional development opportunities. My main thing is for folks to actually have this in their employee files so that their managers and supervisors know that they are working on opportunities to move up the ladder within our department. Some of our challenges, retention. Erin talked a little bit about the pool between, you know, we always have that tapped group, right? The people that go to every training and do everything and are involved in everything. And of course, those are the people that actually come to this training too, but they are overtapped. And so, you know, if there's something else going on, maybe they have to miss a module. So retention is difficult, but because we are running successive cohorts, they do have the opportunity to make it up with another cohort. Our training is not mandatory. And so I think, what did I want to say there? I think that, you know, majority of people that actually come to the training, they want to be there. But we also want to get to the people that don't want to be there, right? And so how do we get to those people as well? Many bureaus see no reimbursement for staff time out of the field. So we struggle with behavioral health. We struggle with environmental health because they have other things to do, which are very important. But we also want them to understand that this will make your employees a little bit more whole. And that's the goal for that. And then there's varying levels of experience with the subject matter. So because this is a self-selection process, you often have people who, you know, maybe this is their life work, this is what they're passionate about, like myself, and they come in with a wealth of information. And then you have other people who haven't really had these conversations at all. So you have folks who want to move to action, and other folks who are just saying, I'm here to learn. One of the biggest things that I learned from Erin, I called him literally the day before my module on Racing to Health, which is our module all about racism. And I'm going over the material with him, and he said, Laquana, don't make it scary. It's already scary for a lot of people. It doesn't need to be scary. And I'm like, oh, because I was looking for the best icebreaker, and I really wanted this wow factor. And then I realized he's absolutely right. There are some people who have never said the R word, right? And so we don't want to make this scary for them. And I think that a lot of the process for the facilitation, you know, my demeanor is really calm. I hope I sound calm standing up here. And so I think that helps with the facilitation of the material. But he's right, you know, the entire module, all of the modules have a shock factor to them. So you don't need to, you know, do more. And then we have difficult subject matter with limited external resources for support. And I put that in there for myself because it's not just so much about the actual folks taking the material, but it's about the facilitators as well. And what kind of self-care actually happens for people who are providing these conversations on a regular basis. I can admit to doing some of these modules and trainings and literally going home for the rest of the day because I am exhausted emotionally and physically for standing there for 4 hours. And then the sustainability piece, but I'm gonna let Mia go into that a little bit more. And then evaluation techniques. So we had some difficulties with the way we started out evaluating our materials. I'll just say it. Our pretest was different from our post-test, and I don't know how that happened, but make sure you pay attention to that, because that was a huge challenge for us in actually coordinating how we came up with, you know, the how people have improved for the, through this process. And then leadership and support and buy-in, of course, is extremely important, but it's also difficult. Here are some of our participation challenges. You can see that in the blue on the far left, 77% were not managers or supervisors, and 23% actually were. So that's a huge pool of line staff, which I hate that term, but you know, people that are giving, providing direct services and interacting with the public. It's a good thing, but we also want to make sure that our leadership is also trained in this information as well. And then you can see on the right, these are our participants by bureau, with public health being the largest, having the largest amount of folks participating in the program. EMS, which is our emergency medical services, we've had little to no participation from them. Environmental health, public guardian as well, clinic services as well. So, you know, we have to do some more innovative techniques to actually bring those folks to the table. The other piece I wanted to mention was our accreditation. We are currently in the process of submitting our paperwork actually for accreditation. And for any other folks that are in that same process, I wanted to mention that for measure 3.13, it requires efforts to specifically address factors that contribute to specific populations' higher health risks and poor health outcomes. And then for standard 5.2, which is the CHIP, the Community Health Improvement Plan, this actually going through this process is huge in the development of what you write for that standard, as well as the Workforce Development Strategy Standards. And then measure 11.14 actually focuses on the policies, processes, programs, and interventions provided that are socially, culturally, and linguistically appropriate to specific populations with higher health risk and poor health outcomes. So if you are in the process of accreditation, please you know, look for how you can make this training your own and incorporate that in your material. And as far as next steps go, in 2016, we hope to have 2 to 3 more cohorts. And then one of the main things that I want to do is actually convene all of our cohort members. We haven't had the opportunity to have everybody who's been through the training in the same room. We're actually also working on the Governing for Racial Equity, which is a county-wide program that we're looking at having this training be used to train all of our county employees as well, along with the Train the Trainers Guide and developing a cultural competency plan for our department as well. And I have my mic, I got my 1 minute time frame, so that is it for me. And we'll take questions at the end.